Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
Hello, friends. You've arrived on Planet Tech Weekly with me, Alex Kratosky, in Paris and in the London studio.
Me, Charles Arthur.
And me, Alex Han.
On this week's show.
I wouldn't go as far as to say it should be an hypochondriac's dream, but it is a device you need, because these are symptoms that you should know of before they turn into something very serious.
As consumer tech and apps continue apace at monitoring our health, Samuel Gibbs meets Hamish Patel from Azoy to find out more about the Wello. Also on the show, we discuss the Turkish government's so far failed attempts to shut down Twitter. Facebook stakes a claim in virtual reality gaming with its purchase of Oculus Rift, and how some people are taking failed economies into their own hands. Down with fiat, up with crypto. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Late last week, the Turkish government announced it was banning access to microblogging platform Twitter to anyone inside the country. The ban, which came after Twitter refused to take down allegations of government corruption, allegedly, which had appeared on the site, has been widely criticized by international free speech organizations and governments. But there's actually a deeper story here. Since the ban, however, enterprising activists have worked to get the country's citizens back on the site through a variety of means, some of which have been successful and others not. We're joined in the studio by reporter Kevin Rawlinson, who's been following this story for The Guardian. Kevin, thank you very much for coming in and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
My first question, what were the grounds upon which Twitter refused to take down these offending tweets?
Well, Twitter's got a long history of refusing to comply straight off with court orders and with government requests. They actually, there was an issue firstly between languages that the Turkish court translated their order into English and sent it to Twitter, but Twitter refused. It was actually a delay. I believe some of the tweets have now been taken down, and the accounts that were supposedly posting, well, one of the issues was that a housewife was made out to be a porn starlet. I believe most of those accounts have now been taken down.
Now, of course, that doesn't have anything to do with allegations of corruption for the government. So that's almost like a traditional takedown request, is it not? So what is the legal basis of the ban? Does it have to do with the alleged tweets about alleged government corruption, of which all of this is alleged?
Well, I think a lot of people presumed initially that it did. I certainly did. I worked on that basis when I reported the story. But there's been quite a lot of interesting reports, one of them from a Turkish writer called Zeynep Tüfekçi, who argued that it's probably more to do with conservative politics in Turkey. It's probably more a play towards Erdogan's supporters. He wants to present social media as a bad source of information. It's less to do with stopping what he sees as leaks that are damaging to his government, because I think he probably realizes that that's impossible anyway. He's seen that too many times.
I want to get into the particulars of that theory in just a little bit. But before we do, Kevin, I want to turn to Charles Arthur. Charles, what can you tell me about how people were initially getting online?
Well, the way that people were getting around the block within Turkey was the fairly traditional way that you see people circumventing these sorts of bans, which is to use a VPN, virtual private network, and in effect tunnel through the barrier that's being put up around sort of incoming traffic to get to, in effect, connect through other countries and view Twitter there. It's quite widely used within China, for example, and that's what a lot of people did in Twitter, including, it seems, the president, because when this ban was in force, the president of Turkey was actually tweeting. So in that sense, it wasn't really a block which had a gigantic effect on the smart people who know how to root around this. And actually, Turkey has about 11 million Twitter users. It's very, very popular in Turkey. And The fact is that they've seen these sorts of blocks before. There was a lot of protests last year in Raisi, which saw government troops attacking protesters, and there was lots of action on Twitter there. Again, the people who are protesting found that they were able to get their tweets out by using things like VPN. Another one called Hotspot Shield, which is a VPN, was rating very highly in the Apple App Store.
All three of the top three free apps on the iTunes App Store are now VPN apps, and I think the fifth and seventh are as well.
That's in Turkey, yeah. Yeah, so people in Turkey know about how to get around this, but to some extent, what it seems that Recep Erdogan is trying to do in Turkey is not to speak to those 11 million, because possibly they're not really his core supporters, but he's trying to reach the people who are not on Twitter or who don't know how to use VPN, and he's trying to basically spread a message about Twitter and social media in general, making Twitter seem like it's bad through looking at the example of this housewife who was sort of misrepresented as a porn starlet, and doing something when it seemed as though Twitter itself would not do something.
Well, quite, Kevin. I want to look at this on a more global level. The international media community has really jumped on this story. The idea that Twitter is banned. Why is a microblogging site considered so important? After all, this isn't like Egypt. This isn't like other governments who have literally tried to ban the entire internet. So why are we focusing on Twitter and this might, are we not sort of blowing it out of proportion?
Well, perhaps. I mean, it depends on the premise for the outrage, as it were. I mean, people in democratic nations are probably always going to be quite outraged if anything is censored or banned for whatever reason, almost whatever reason, apart from perhaps national security. But if you are working from the premise that something is being banned because it's been seen to carry a message or to send a message that damages the government, people are always going to be angry about that. And I think while we may be misrepresented or misunderstanding Erdogan's own intentions, that still exists, and it is still true that Twitter is banned in Turkey.
Alex, I want to look more broadly again at some of the other technologies that have been recently released to help people on the ground to access technologies, to access bits of the web that are unavailable. And this kind of goes beyond VPNs. You mentioned something earlier to me before we started recording, which is called, it starts with fire. I keep thinking of Fireside, which makes me think of Jimmy Carter. What is this technology?
So there's a new app for iPhones only currently called FireChat, which has got a lot of buzz as something that could get around restrictions implemented of the sort that Turkey's done. What it does, it uses a new feature in iOS 7 called mesh networking. Essentially, what happens is each iPhone looks for any other iPhone in the area and connects to it. That in itself isn't that unusual, but what it also does is it offers to pass messages on from iPhones to other iPhones. If you've got enough iPhones in an area and they're all running this app, you can pass messages over quite a long distance, bouncing from iPhone to iPhone to iPhone to iPhone to iPhone until they reach their intended recipient. That is essentially unblockable. It doesn't go through any central server, and it doesn't even use the internet as we know it at all. If you have, it doesn't even require a group of protesters. If you just have every house on a street running it, you can use it as a replacement for Google Chat. It hasn't got wide adoption yet, even in the countries where it's launched. But the possibilities for it seem quite welcoming.
Kevin, thank you for joining us. And you can read more on this as it unfolds at theguardian.com/technology. Hot in the heels of its WhatsApp purchase this week, Facebook announced a $2 billion deal to acquire the plucky virtual reality gaming headset, Oculus Rift. Alex Hearn, the WhatsApp purchase made some kind of sense, but what's Mark Zuckerberg doing getting interested in gaming?
Well, I mean, The first interesting thing about this purchase, which was for $400 million in cash and $1.6 billion in Facebook stocks, is that actually Mark Zuckerberg didn't mention games in his public explanation as to why he bought Oculus at all. The company has up until now been very strongly identified with gaming. Its CTO is John Carmack, the former developer of Doom, and a lot of what it's shown has been impressive ways of, you know, turning virtual reality into the future of gaming. But for Mark Zuckerberg, it's more about experience. It's about how Oculus and virtual reality can be used to revolutionize our social life. In terms of how he sees it actually being put into the home, the most likely guess is something equivalent to what Sony wants to do with its Morpheus headset and turn it into a sort of avatar-based social network. In essence, what we've seen in science fiction for years, people wandering around and talking to each other in a fully immersive 3D environment. Whether that will work and whether Oculus can overcome its vaguely dorky associations, because wearing a full VR headset does leave you looking like a slack-jawed cyborg, that we'll have to see whether Facebook's money can help.
Frankly, I think the name as well doesn't give it too much of a cool cred, except amongst the geek kids. Tell me a little bit about the background of Oculus Rift. Where have they come from? Who are they?
So Oculus is the company. They make the gaming headset, the Rift. They first came to public attention in September 2012, where they raised $2.5 million on Kickstarter. It was at the time one of the biggest Kickstarters ever. It still is. They beat their initial aim tenfold. They were looking to raise $250,000. 9,600 people later, they got $2.4 million. And in the 18 months since then, they do seem to have gone from strength to strength, barring the tragic death of their co-founder. When John Carmack came on board as CTO, people looked around and said, oh, you know, maybe this is something that's worth paying attention to. It does seem to be one of those things which you have to use it to believe in it. There's very few people who've actually sat down and spent a couple of hours with it on who haven't come out as some sort of believer. But at the same time, if you haven't sat down with it, all you see is these images of people wearing it, looking slightly dorky, and then saying, no, it's amazing, you've got to use it. The difficulty for Oculus in the future will be getting it into people's hands and demonstrating that firsthand. The other question that this raises is sort of tangential to Oculus, and it's about the nature of Kickstarter. $2.5 million was put in by people, you know, treating Kickstarter as this weird pseudo pre-order, pseudo I'm giving you money because what you do looks cool. And then just 18 months later, they've come out with $2 billion profit. Obviously, none of that goes to the backers. On the one hand, that's not something you expect when you put money into a Kickstarter project. No one really seriously thinks they're investing in a company. On the other hand, it's hard for Kickstarter to maintain both an image of, you know, you're donating to plucky artists and designers, while some of those artists and designers come out the other side making billions off your money. You know, there are a lot of backers today who are going, this is nice, you know, this small company I helped out has done good. At the same time, the thing that rubs the wrong way is that some of these people were given quite hefty amounts of money. You know, the top reward was $5,000. Kickstarter itself is adamant that Kickstarter is not a shop. So you can't push it aside as easily as, oh, well, they paid for a product and they got their product. And crowdfunding with equity is a thing that exists. The problem is, it's kind of yet more reduction of consumers to one role. What you can do if you're a consumer, if you're not an enlightened venture capitalist, if you don't have millions of dollars to throw around, what you can do is buy stuff. That's it. If you want to help a small company, buy stuff. If you want to donate, buy stuff. If you want to buy stuff, buy stuff. There's nothing else that we can do, and it starts to get kind of depressing when other people make billions off your buying.
But when people put the money into Kickstarter, you know, when they were raising this money, what actually were they getting in return?
Well, what they were getting in return was, if they put $300 in, they were getting an Oculus Rift. But the problem is, if Oculus had gone bust and never delivered, Kickstarter is not a shop. They wouldn't have got a penny. They were taking on exactly the same risks that venture capitalists do when they invest in an early stage company. They were gambling that Oculus would deliver the product that they said they would deliver, and that Oculus would, you know, in the long run, become a company that would give useful things for this product.
Well, it's slightly different from a VC, though, isn't it? Because a VC puts a small amount of money in, comparatively small, and hopes to make a whacking great exit on it. The person putting $300 in doesn't expect to get $3 million; they expect to get a headset.
Right.
So, in that sense, they're you know, it's a very clear return.
Well, unless they don't get the headset. And the thing is, Kickstarter projects don't always deliver, and don't always deliver on time as well. This is the other thing. If you're paying $300 for it, I mean, I should say, Oculus actually were a paragon of Kickstarter. They delivered on time. They delivered what they promised, partially because they were already a fairly well-running company beforehand. This was not something that they needed to tool up. They delivered the Oculus very soon after. But at the same time, if you put in money for one of the competing virtual reality headsets, I cannot remember its name, but it finished its Kickstarter in June 2012 and still hasn't delivered. After a certain point, even if it does deliver, you're getting hardware that's 2 years out of date, that isn't compatible, that's been superseded. You know, you're taking on risks in joining Kickstarter, and those risks seem okay if you take it as donating to help a struggling artist maybe make their vinyl. You know, maybe even if they don't record anything, this musician that you donate to, you're still helping someone who you like. When it starts entering the realms of commerce,
Charles, I want to look at the details of what's actually happened with Facebook. So we've had the experience, we've had the situation in which Facebook has plonked out quite a considerable amount of money for this product. You are a veteran of virtual reality. What can you imagine Facebook will do to create the social world other than create a fully immersive Second Life?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, I mean, rewind about 20 years and I was visiting a company which I think was in Nottingham called Virtuality, which had virtual reality headsets. And what it was finding was a sort of a good enough application at the time was amusement arcade systems. So you would put some money in and you would shoot down pterodactyls. It was okay. It was quite sort of convincing-ish given the computing limitations of the time. Virtuality didn't sort of go anywhere. And the whole VR thing went into a bit of a decline. Atari, then in those days, you know, a games company, was going to build a VR headset called the Jaguar, but they discovered that people got sort of motion sickness, an illness, if they used it. You know, they just felt queasy, basically, if they used it for any time. And the problem was you couldn't really sell something for gaming if you thought that it was actually going to make a significant proportion of your users, you know, feel ill about it. And what happened instead was that, you know, the internet happened, and so people sort of focused on other things. Now virtual reality is sort of back a bit, certainly through this and Sony's Project Morpheus, which seems to be, you know, the new way to really have immersive games. The screens have improved a great deal. And the question now is, what actually do you want to use virtual reality for? I've got to say, I've seen so many of these scenarios sort of described with enormous hand wavings. And, you know, every week or so, it seems like someone says, and I've got a great new 3D interface for the web. And I go, yeah, I've seen that one regularly about every 5 years, and it's never taken off because people don't want a 3D navigation for the web. You know, they don't want a 3D navigation for their file system. Even though it's fantastically fun when you see it visualized, it's not actually how you imagine what you're doing. We tend to be very 2D in this. And I think John Carmack's involvement in Oculus is interesting because you could imagine Doom with a virtual reality headset where you really thought you were running around. That would be pretty amazing.
But we're talking about Farmville, and I can't really imagine, you know, that and throwing zombies around. That's not really the raison d'etre of Facebook. It's a social network.
Well, no, but he's saying that he sees VR really as being the next step after mobile. So he's seeing it as a new immersive way to connect with people. I mean, it all sounds a bit like sort of Neil Stephenson's Snow Crash or, you know, William Gibson's Neuromancer. You know, the immersive, the internet's the place that you go where you're another person. You know, and it's in that sense, perhaps it's a bit like Second Life, except that you're sort of seeing it rather than just doing it on a screen.
Well, indeed, actually. And both of those books were direct inspirations for that that social network, that virtual 3D environment, and many of those that came before. It's interesting that you say, though, after mobile, because as far as I'm aware, and do correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I'm aware, Facebook is really trying to be mobile first. How can a virtual reality headset help to achieve that objective?
Well, the way he lays it out, he's seeing it as a sort of a third wave after the desktop, after mobile, you get on to immersive VR. I don't know if that's quite how it pans out, but you can sort of, if you squint at it hard enough, you can sort of imagine it. But I don't know, maybe Alex has a view.
For me, the place where it slots in, if we're accepting games, is entertainment more broadly. The first time someone makes a good movie for Oculus Rift, it will be astonishing. When you wear it, it really is all-encompassing. It's not quite as good as some people say. The first demo I was given was ostensibly put me on a roller coaster and bored me to tears, because the whole point of roller coasters is the physical sensation, not just what you see and hear. But at the same time, you know, we're talking way, way more immersive than 3D. This is, you look behind you and you see what is behind you. You look up, you look down, and you see everything surrounding you. A movie, it is. I mean, it's nothing new. It's just executed better than it ever has been before, for a lower price scale than it ever has been before. And also with, as far as I can tell, more external developers interested in doing stuff for it than ever before, which is a massively important thing. The more minds you get thrown at this, the more likely you are going to get something useful coming out of it. At the same time, it is dorky, it is bulky, it's an incredibly isolating experience. It's not something you share with others. It's something you sit alone in a darkened room doing. And I think that will be a bigger hurdle to widespread adoption than a lot of people are giving it credit for. The sort of people who've used Oculus Rift so far are the sort of people who don't see a problem with social activities which are, you know, done alone. You're communicating over the internet. You grew up playing video games alone in your room, because that's who Oculus is aiming at. If it's going to get wider adoption, it's going to need to break that. Basically, until it's retinal implants, I'm not seeing it.
Well, we look forward to the forward march of VR headsets to retinal implants, and also the third wave of social networking after mobile. We'll be covering all of that, of course, on theguardian.com/technology. This week, a breakaway group of economic activists launched Aurora Coin, a new cryptocurrency for the country of Iceland. Wait a minute, that is a whole bunch of nonsense words I've just said. Let's break this down. Alex Hearn, what the heck am I talking about?
What we've got here is a new electronic currency, which is very similar to Bitcoin. It's based on something which is based on Bitcoin, called Litecoin. It's set up by pseudonymous creator, who signs his name Baldur Frigga Odinson. And it's basically, it's pitched as a way of getting around Iceland's capital controls. Baldur has written quite a lengthy manifesto in which he rails against not only the Icelandic government's post-2008 restriction on taking Icelandic krona out of Iceland, but also their economic policy of the last 50 years, the fact that the Icelandic krona has lost almost 99% of its value against US dollars, and the fact that the US dollar has lost its value against gold. It's all the sort of stuff that we hear Bitcoin fans saying quite a lot. What's interesting about Aurora Coin is that rather than just being something like Bitcoin, where people can switch to it and put their computers to mining it and then spend their money freely using digital apps, he's actually doing what he's calling an airdrop. As in, if you are an Icelandic citizen, and Iceland has a very useful open registry of all Icelandic citizens, he will give you 31 Aurora coin, which is currently around $370 worth of coin. And that is real money. You can already sell Aurora coins for Bitcoin at a value of about $11 a coin, because you can then sell Bitcoins for US dollars. Ideally, if everything goes as planned, what he's done is he's created a currency of some real value, seeded it throughout the
population of Iceland, and then the population of Iceland will all just switch merrily to using Aurora coin, and the Icelandic Central Bank won't be able to impose those capital controls anymore.
So this ultimately is a political statement.
Yeah, it is. I mean, he's very clear about that. Part of the manifesto says that the power must be taken away from the politicians and given back to the people. Cryptocurrencies are a very important milestone in this fight for liberty. They bring the hope of a new era of free currencies immune to the meddling of politicians and their cronies. At the same time, though, Bitcoin would offer a similar way of getting around these capital controls that anger Bolo so much, except the problem is that Iceland is actually aware of this possibility. The Central Bank of Iceland has banned Icelanders buying Bitcoin from foreign sellers using Icelandic currency, and they've banned Icelanders using Bitcoin really to buy imports as well. So that law seems like it would pass relatively easy to Aurora coin, and the whole basis for creating the damn thing would be thrown up in the air.
Which means that the people of Iceland would each have 31, what, just sort of crypto numbers, effectively, that they could do whatever it is that they want with. I mean, I'm assuming that they have to, as you say, there's an exchange rate for Aurora coins and Bitcoins. They would have to actually do such a thing in order to be able to purchase anything, any experiences, any items, any access. So would it suddenly isolate Iceland's cryptocurrency opportunities, or would it open them up to a different kind of experience with international trade?
Are you going to get anyone in Iceland be able to buy from America using Aurora coin, or be able to buy from British sellers using Aurora coin? It seems unlikely, because if you're outside of Iceland, the market for selling things in Aurora coin is very low. It's quite odd. What they've done is taken the first ever currency designed to be truly global, designed to be completely abstracted from the worlds of nations and borders, and just removed all of that advantage and instead made it rather parochial, based in just one country of 330,000 people. And yeah, it's entirely possible that they end up with money which they can only spend in Iceland, which is essentially what Iceland already has.
Are there other national cryptocurrencies?
So at the same time as Aurora coin has been created, there's at least two others that I've been able to find. There is the Scotcoin project, which is an attempt to pre-mine a whole load of Scotcoins and then hand them out. 1,000 Scotcoins will go to each adult resident in Scotland, not Scottish citizens. There's also Gael coin, which is an Irish equivalent. They're giving 50 coins away. But none of them seem to be anywhere near as fully formed as Aurora coin. Scott coin is relatively ahead. They've got around 800 people supporting them. But they are still, for the most part, in the conception stage.
Well, they still have until the 18th of September before the referendum to mine as many as they possibly can. I mean, surely this could solve Alex Salmond's pound sterling problems if Scotcoin becomes the de facto currency.
I think, having spoken to the Scotcoin people, they would quite like to get ahead before then. Their issue isn't so much a pro-nationalist point. They're not trying to provide a currency that the future Scotland will use instead of the pound. Instead, it's that currently the future of Scotland's economy is rather unclear. You don't know for sure that in 20 years they're going to be using pounds versus euros or the Scottish pound. The point of the Scotcoin project is that no matter what happens with independence, if everyone is using Scotcoin, a cryptocurrency which is free of all government interference and all of the rest of the old canal to Bitcoin, then it doesn't really matter what happens in independence. It doesn't matter what Alex Salmond decides, because currency and the economy will be free from control.
So you mentioned that we've got three countries here that have an interesting sort of economic issues, whether they're, you know, stable or unstable, just interesting economic sort of turmoil going on at the moment. Iceland, this is an Icelandic cryptocurrency, the Aurora coin, the Gael coin, which is the Ireland's, and the Scott coin, Scotland's. What about places where the economy is frankly broken? Places like Greece or Spain or Italy. Are we seeing any kinds of alternative currencies arising? Are these possibilities for, is the cryptocurrency, that sort of national cryptocurrency, a possibility for some countries, where things are basically going downhill rapidly?
By and large, the thing that seems to promote uptake of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin in places that are suffering real economic turmoil is the ability to get your money out of the country fast. One of the big reasons for the initial media attention around Bitcoin in, when was it, January 2013, I guess, was Cyprus, which at the time had instituted its own capital controls. And there was a lot of anecdotal information going around that rich Cypriots who could no longer send euros out of the country were buying a lot of Bitcoin and moving that Bitcoin out of the country and then selling it for pounds in Great Britain and buying expensive property in London. Recently, we've also heard the similar thing happening in China, which has quite strong capital controls. Again, rich Chinese people buy Bitcoin and then sell it into Hong Kong dollars or US dollars. The problem is that if you're trying to use it for day-to-day transactions, even amongst stable working economies with, you know, incredibly developed infrastructures, it's quite hard to even just guarantee that you've got enough mobile phone signal to actually move your daily life onto Bitcoin. I've tried. I've stood trying to get 3G signal in a market in Brick Lane to buy a burger with Dogecoin. It's quite difficult. And so if you're positing that in the middle of an economic turmoil, people will move to something which requires them to start carrying more technology around, which requires them to make huge capital investments on buying shiny new tills. It's all rather unlikely. I mean, if anything is going to happen, it's going to be what we normally see in economic turmoil, which is people going back to essentially scrip, to IOUs, to a community currency.
Well, you can follow the rise and rise and the rise of the cryptocurrency bubble at theguardian.com/technology. Wearable tech is practically synonymous nowadays with health and fitness apps, with a myriad of companies pushing exercise trackers, heart rate and blood pressure monitors, food intake diaries, and sleep monitors. I actually live in a house where everything is wearable and everything is monitored. I'm serious. I even have a device for my dog. But obsessive compulsive tendencies aside, these things claim to be part of the Health 2.0 movement, participatory integrated feedback mechanisms about the stuff we can't see inside our bodies, both for our own interests and for the interests of health professionals. Apart from those that are on our persons or our animals, all the time, there's also an enormous trove of monitoring devices that can be purchased for the devices we carry around so much that they're practically part of us too. I'm talking here about smartphones, and smartphones are getting kitted out with their own mHealth tech. Samuel Gibbs met the creators of one such creature, the Wello, the smartphone case that gets baseline measurements of everything from heart rate to blood pressure and lung capacity.
Hi, thanks for having me here. My name is Hamish Patel, and I'm the CEO and founder at Azoi. We're in the health and mobile computing space, and we have designed Wello, which is a health monitoring device.
Wello is basically an iPhone case, and when you look at it, it's almost indistinguishable from any sort of other iPhone case. It's thin, it clips on the back, and you really wouldn't know it was anything more than, say, like an ultra-thin case. And that's the beauty of this system. This is not some bulky accessory. It's not something that you need to stick in your bag and lug around. This weighs next to nothing, and you really wouldn't even notice it on your phone until you come to use it. How does Wello actually work?
It has a Bluetooth chipset embedded into the case. So you connect your phone to the case via the Bluetooth.
And when you're actually using it, how do you get from your bodily functions to a readout on the screen?
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. What we managed to do was shrink all the electronics and embed it within the case. And it has four hidden hotspots where you hold the case from. And you just have to touch it, and hidden sensors immediately start taking your body vital readings.
And how long does this process take?
It takes less than 10 seconds.
Less than 10 seconds to basically tell you whether you're doing all right or not.
Yeah. So we take a lot of body function vital measurements. We take your ECG, your blood pressure, your oximetry. So about 15 to 20 body vitals, which are very, very important for you to keep a track of your health.
And you can get an attachment for measuring your lung function?
Yes, so Wello actually comes with a spiral attachment, which clips onto the case, and you blow into it for a few seconds, and we'll tell you how your lungs are doing too.
So the instant readout of whether you're going to cark it in the next 10 minutes?
No, so it's not positioned for a diagnostic tool, but we'll tell you how your lungs are functioning at that time. And over time, you can also see a pattern of how your lungs are doing, which can help you take or make better lifestyle choices.
So quit smoking.
Quit smoking, yeah. You don't need Velo for that. You should quit anyways.
And move out of London, perhaps. Yes. So for the average UK user, what's the benefit of having Velo on your phone?
So there was nothing that existed until now that helped you keep a regular check of your heart and lungs. And heart and lung diseases are two of the three biggest killers in the world. And it's really surprising that there is nothing that has come up until now which will help you keep a track of your heart and your lungs and that of your family's health. And we're trying to solve that problem and make it very, very easy, affordable, and accessible for you to get those vitals.
So you stick your fingers on the sensors and on the strips on the top, but then what does it give you?
Right. So, it connects to your phone via Bluetooth, and you have a Velo app which shows you a real-time reading of your body vitals. So you will be able to see what your oxygen levels are, what your ECG looks like, what your heart rate is, what your systolic and diastolic blood pressure rates are, what your respiration is, what your temperature is, and similar. So we show a few more heart function tests. Similarly, when you attach the Spiro attachment to Velo and blow into it for a few seconds, and the app will also show you how your lungs are doing. So we'll show you the volume of your lungs and airflow and a few more readings which are important to give you a vital assessment of how your lungs are.
Looking at the app, so each section gives you a readout. Can you describe to me, how do you make it intelligible by the average person on the street?
Right. So because everyone's readings are very, very unique, you won't have two people having the same kind of readings. It is more personalized than that. Even temperature, which is a very simple reading, is not the same. My normal is not the same as your normal. And because you have a device like this, which is on you most of the times, your phone actually knows what your normals are. So whenever your readings go above or below your normal, we'll red flag it for you so you can take an action based on that.
So I'm looking at the Velo app right now, and as you can see, your blood oxygen level in a simple reading, your heart rate, your blood pressure, respiratory rate, and temperature. But going beyond that, it'll even give you an ECG in an easy-to-read graph. It's the kind of thing that you would see in a hospital, but hooked up to a massive machine, and this is now shrunk into the palm of your hand. This kind of thing is... I've never seen this on a phone before, and it goes way beyond the kind of interfaces and things like that that Samsung and things are pushing with their heart rate monitors, etc. This is much more of a true kind of medical readout in a simplified form that your average Joe can actually use. Basically, you could be reading your heart rate whilst you're perhaps watching the latest episode of Top Gear.
Absolutely, or when you're playing Angry Birds on your phone. It's as simple as that.
Is that not dangerous? You know, the insane frustration, suddenly your heart spikes and you warp your readings. So
no.
Could you have like a during Angry Birds and a post Angry Birds kind of readout?
Yes, it's very interesting because the app actually also ties up with your Fitbit or devices that you already own. So more active devices in the sense. And we take the readings and our app actually syncs with the Fitbit data or such similar devices, a weighing scale, for example, and we'll club that data with the body vitals and we give you much deeper analysis. So if you're in an active state, for example, if you're running, your heart rate would probably be higher. And because it's on your phone, we know that you're moving and we have that data and we factor that into our body vital assessment. So if you're moving a lot, because it's on your phone, we already know you're moving a lot. And we'll let you know that this is not, this reading was taken while you were very active. You should probably calm down and then take it again. Or we'll just show you your data when you were active. So
if somebody wanted to look at their heart rate, for instance, when exercising, could they use it for that task?
We do not recommend they do that because we'd rather you be calm and sit down in a particular position or a posture when you're doing this. But it is technically possible to do that with Velo.
And how many other trackers and things like that do you currently integrate with?
Right now, at launch, we'll probably be adding a lot more trackers. But at the moment, we have just disclosed Fitbit. But we'll be probably be doing many more devices once we're shipping.
And so that generates a much more comprehensive view of your...
Yes. So if you're an active user, you have a very active lifestyle, you're a runner or a swimmer, you can actually sync all that data into the Velo app and have a broader view of what's happening on your body.
This collects quite a lot of personal information. And in the wrong hands, it could be used to quite devastating effects. I mean, if you think about insurance, for instance, health insurance, if this is an absolute goldmine of data for them. How do you go about making sure your data stays private?
Yeah, so as a company, we're very, very sensitive about the user's information. And just to be clear, your data is your own. And Azoy or Velo app does not back up any data to the cloud unless you allow us to. And even when you allow us to back up that data, we anonymize all that data before it hits our servers. So if there was, for example, hypothetically, if someone were to hack into our servers and take all that data, or if someone got access to the data, that data could never be tied back to the user ever.
Okay, so NSA proof.
Yeah, I mean...
nothing's NSA proof, right? Who knows, yes. From a perspective of, say, you've got this data and you're not feeling great and you want to share it with your doctor, how does one go about doing that?
Right, so we have a feature where you can share through the app, you can share the data with your physician or your family doctor. You could also share it with your family. But again, that is that feature is available only in a few countries to start with. We're trying to follow protocols in each country. And in a lot of countries, there are regulations that actually do not allow us to launch this immediately. So we're going through the approval process, even for the application that allow us to share the data with your GP, for example, in the UK. But in most countries, this will be available at launch as a feature, where it's much faster for us to enroll it out.
All right. So you're saying British bureaucracy is getting in the way again?
No. So it's not very difficult in UK. So you should probably expect this feature rolling out in UK much sooner than in other countries. But yes, even UK has a few protocols, but it's pretty straightforward.
And when will it be available actually in somebody's hands?
So Velo will be shipping in a lot of countries in summer this year. And in US in fall of this year, pending an FDA approval. In UK, you should probably expect it in summer this year too.
So this kind of connected health, quantified self kind of realm is definitely expanding. I mean, we saw at MWC in February, Samsung went all out. Its new flagship Android phone has a heart rate monitor in it. Its three smartwatches all have some sort of activity tracking plus heart rate. Where do you see, what's the next step for the quantified self?
I think the next step, I can tell you what the next step should be, and it should be an ecosystem play. And as more and more of these sensors get embedded into our everyday lives, if there is a central service that actually helps you make sense of all that data. I mean, I see that you're wearing a Shine. Mm. But again, Shine tells you how much you've walked in a day. And it's limited to that. Imagine a Shine being synced with something like a Velo. And there is a service which helps you analyze and make sense of all that data as to how much you've walked or how much you've slept and how is that affecting your body vitals. That is very empowering to you as a user.
We've been promised kind of like biometrics are going to lead to some sort of personalized health service. Are we ever going to get there? I mean, the integrated apps and the trackers and things like that give so much more information than we ever had. Do you think this is going to lead to some sort of personal medicine revolution?
Yes, I think, and there are very, very interesting companies working in this space. I mean, just to start with what we're doing with Velo, you're getting so many key body vitals right now, just on your fingertips, and all you have to do is hold your phone. Who would have thought of that? And add that with something like 23andMe, they give you a personal genomics of yourself. And once you start getting all that data, I'm sure there'll be a lot of interesting applications and use cases of that data in improving how healthcare is delivered in a personal way.
So can you see an end to the trip to the GP? Say you Skype your GP on your phone and he says, press your fingers on these contacts and we'll see how you're doing, Sam. And then he can diagnose over the thing, and if it's serious, yes, of course you go to hospital.
I think that should start happening. However, I think a GP has a much higher role than just in your life than just telling you that you're serious. I think a GP is a personal attachment to your GP, I think, is very, very necessary, and I don't think we should try and replace a doctor because. We do not look at it or use cases of these devices to replace a doctor.
What about in developing worlds where seeking medical advice is often difficult?
That was also one of the reasons we made Velo, because we think while it's a great device to have in every family, even in the developed countries where it could be a lifestyle product. I mean, you should definitely have one in your family. But imagine having one Velo and an Android phone or an iPhone back in India or in Africa where healthcare access is next to nothing, right? So one Velo and an app could actually service a whole village, and they would not need to travel hundreds of kilometers just to get their oximetry done or an ECG, a basic ECG done. And sure, if you're showing spikes or your readings are not normal, you can make that trip.
Are we going to get to the point where you could have almost automated health? So you're fine. Oh, you're not so fine. Go and seek medical attention.
I think we should be getting there now. I mean, it is time that we have all these devices taking your readings. And as we improve technology, we see that in a few years, we should probably have that.
So it's going to be the hypochondriac's dream.
Well, it is something that us as humans, we need it more. I wouldn't go as far as to say it should be an hypochondriac's dream, but it is a device you need, because again, these are symptoms that you should know of before they turn into something very serious. So
An early warning system,
right? So I think these devices will fill that gap in a very good way.
So thanks a lot for joining us, and good luck with the launch.
Thank you very much.
That was Samuel Gibbs speaking with Hemish Patel, CEO and co-founder of Azoy, the company behind the Velo. The case is out later this year and is available for pre-order now at around £120 sterling. That's all we have for this week from the show. As always, you can read deeper into the stories we've discussed today at theguardian.com/technology. Next week, we're back with more. Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps. I'm Alex Krotowski. Bye for now.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.